Welcome to Ancient Afterlives, surprisingly modern ideas about the ancient world. This week, Kat Gwyther and Joe Scales sit down for a coffee chat, talking about all the things that they've been reading recently.
About Ancient Afterlives, I'm quite excited to have more people come on board. Because I think like part of the vision from the beginning is very much that it wants to be a bit of a platform for people working on their PhDs, people who are kind of maybe looking for jobs, people who are often not necessarily those who are invited or who don't have the time to do conference presentations and things like that, just to have a venue where maybe if they are not thinking of staying in academia or they're kind of leaving it behind, but obviously a lot of people in our position have devoted a lot of time and energy to these kind of topics, so we're often still thinking about things and kind of want to be involved in some way, and it's like a nice low-key way to do that. And the vision from the beginning is that it can be open enough that anyone who wants to kind of jump on and contribute has means to do that. So I think like expanding beyond just a few of us will be quite good, because then in my head it can become like, oh yeah, we've got, you know, a group over here who's do lots of recordings in the States, so anyone who's being interviewed there, they can do like time zone issues, and then once they've got a good episode together, they can just upload it in a queue almost, so we've got things that are just being put up independently in a backlog. That'd be nice.
And I think the like collaborative side as well is important, like, because we're working together, there's so much, especially when you're doing a PhD, as much as you do talk to other people and you do work with other people, a lot of it is just inside your own head, and actually having opportunities to talk through ideas, paper you're working on, or just have conversations about cool research that interests you, is actually something that I really value, because I spend so much of my time in my thesis, in my head, and actually making those connections makes my work better, but it makes me see things that I haven't seen before. So that's what I'm excited about with like these kind of collaborative projects, is that you actually get so many different angles. Like thinking about Lottie's episode on kind of environmental misogyny, it's nothing that I write about. I have absolutely no clue to the extent that she does, but even when she was talking about it, I was like, oh, I can see that in those Torah texts, and that's an image that I've come across. Or even thinking now about a little bit that I'm working on, actually some of the images are relating back to kind of those colonialist and gendered ideas that she's talking about. So it's really interesting then to make those connections in places that I wouldn't necessarily assume that they were there or seen before.
Very much, yeah. It's like just listening back to a few of them, everyone's doing very cool kind of interesting things, and they often seem kind of disconnected, but you know, as always, you just relate it back to your own interests and work. And I think this is another thing with expanding the team, like having some rotating interviews for different things. And I think one of the ideas we'd initially floated was doing like the same interview twice but with different interviewers, and just see what that would look like. But so far, like, yeah, Simeon and you have both been really good. There's just this kind of relaxed feel to them, and what I do kind of like is that it's some way between like being very, very involved in the conversation, which sometimes can be a bit much, like you might tune into an episode just to listen to that particular person, you won't hear as much about what their topic is and this kind of stuff. But it's not, I think I've listened to some things where it's a little bit more passive, so an interview is very much more or less just a soundboard for someone to kind of talk. So I think it's a nice balance between those kind of two extremes. It's quite nice, and I think it has a good rhythm to it. And it also, you just then, roots of the conversation don't really go along scripted lines. Like, we've kind of had the pre-interview meetings that have been, okay, this is kind of what we'll talk about. And there are some things that sometimes go back to, but often it's very much quite organic, and whatever
yeah.
Interviewer wants to talk about, it kind of goes towards all kinds of different directions, which is quite nice in some ways. It's quite different from a conference paper. Like we've done reading things ahead of time, but I think that's something we might kind of have sometimes. But particularly for if we start with round tables, so having maybe 3 to 4 to 5 people sit around and talk about a subject that they all work on, no one really needs to read anything. And in that case, it can kind of be like a bit of scholarly output, like thinking about ideas that other people allowed without even having to have written a short conference paper, which is kind of quite nice.
Yeah, I can hear myself. I listened to the first episode back recently, and there's a point you talk about. I need to get the reference off you, actually, because it's a really great quote that I want to use. But you talk about, right. like, we're not talking about what it means to be Jewish, we're talking about what it means to be a Jewish man, about kind of
the
circumcision conversation. And there's a bit, and I can just hear myself being like, yes! And I think, but it's almost like cut out because Simeon starts a question, but I just remember that point just being really excited. And I think, yeah, I think that's what I love about that kind of natural flow, is that they're not still two questions, but I was just like, oh, that's such a good point. And just kind of letting the conversation flow from that. But it's really interesting going back and listening. And I was just like, I remember getting really excited about that, but just that coming out of nowhere. But it's always one of those like really small things. It's like, of course. But when someone says it, you're like, oh, yeah, that's groundbreaking.
I mean, the nice thing, so I think that reference was probably Cynthia Baker.
Yes.
And I've got that article if you wanted to read it. It's very good. Like, interestingly enough, actually, almost on a related note, my copy of Fragmented Women has arrived today. So I finally got that.
I will be borrowing that or making you scan some things for me, because I read like a chapter of that undergraduate for an essay, but I'd never kind of explored the whole volume. I don't think I was at the point where I could legitimately read books.
Right. that's another interesting process you kind of go through, just the amount you can consume. So I went back, I think, kind of last year when we were packing up to move, and I've still got this box. It's now in storage, and it's got over the years I've phased out and gotten rid of some undergrad notes, but everything I wrote and was marked in undergrad essays is in there. And I go to some of these bibliographies and it's kind of like, there's not a lot here, and the books that are here, I don't think, I probably just looked at the index or something like that. Whereas, like now this would be something I'll just read. I was having a quick look this morning as well. So this is the second edition, and there's quite a nice preface to the second edition. And this is J. Cheryl Exum's Fragmented Women. She reflects a little bit on, since writing the book, I think 1993 or something, it was in the 90s.
That sounds familiar.
Like feminist scholarship and biblical studies has become like kind of quite diffuse in some ways, and it's here, there, and everywhere, and very often quite concentrated. So you might write something very, very specific on a particular figure or a book or tradition or something. And a lot of what this does is very holistic. I mean, I've still got to get into it. So I think it is that from the index, and looks at lots and lots of different things. But one of the things she brings up in the new preface, or the new foreword, I guess, the new introduction to volume two, edition two, is daring guesswork on kind of gender studies. And there's kind of this little debate over, okay, are we feminist scholars, or are we scholars of gender and this kind of stuff, and the kind of overlapping but sometimes distinct approaches. And it just kind of struck me as like it's really interesting seeing that. So I think the second edition came out in 2016, so that must be, 23 years, something like that, between.
But even,
and the changes... Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, even that for feminist biblical studies, the explosion of kind of research, or like, put it in air quotes, feminist biblical studies, however you want to define that, but thinking like Rhiannon Grabill this year coming text after Terror. So the kind of aftermath of Phyllis Chibble's Text of Terror work. I need to use the term seminal then. That would be the worst context to use it.
Yeah.
But I used it jokingly and now it's come back into my everyday vocabulary and I can't stop it and I hate it. But I haven't found a... I was starting to joke about it, but it's really now become a problem. But yeah.
Oh, no.
I know.
Just as an explanator on that, because I've had to explain this to a couple of people, like good friends and their writing and things when I've read their writing, and they use it because it's become so seminal as when you talk about a piece of work that, you know, redefines a field or generates a whole new wave of scholarship, this kind of thing. And I think it's probably somewhere it's written down, but it's really Twitter discourse that has alerted me to this kind of like really this is bound up in like patriarchy and mm-hmm. things like actually it's the male seed that is this thing which then goes on and it's slightly distasteful I think for a few people, so like a lot of us have moved away from using it and talk about things as generative or influential or you know they kickstart a new field, so just to lay a bit of groundwork before we really go into, but you've been doing it ironically and now it's bled back in.
It was ironic in reference to a friend talking about reproduction and reproductive discourse and kind of conceptual metaphors about seed and semen and offspring, and I was like this is the only context in which you can use the word seminal and it not be a bit weird, because I have read some stuff where I've read it and I'm not sure that seminal is exactly what you mean here, because actually in this context it comes across really creepy. But I was saying to my friend, I was like, this is a perfect excuse to get that word in, and I was joking about that, but now I'm like, oh, it's actually a really good term. It kind of its meaning like encapsulates what I want to say, and because it's so prominent within like scholarship, especially a lot of scholarship that I read, I end up picking it up and I have to think, oh, no, like what's another term I have to use here, because I'm so alert to it. But yeah, because I've been joking about it, it's just kind of wormed its way back into my writing vocabulary, and I want it gone, but it's one of those words. But yeah, things like Phyllis Chibble and Cheryl Exum's work being so kind of explosive in the 90s, but even so Cheryl Exum rewriting or republishing this edition, 6 years in biblical studies for again air quotes feminist biblical studies, there's been such an explosion of work in that 6 years that actually it'll be interesting to kind of read the text, which I'm gonna hope that I get to do someday, maybe even asking you for some cheeky photos. But actually reading that as something that's not in biblical studies 6 years, that's not loads of time. And seeing actually how much has changed in the discipline, because during guest work on kind of gender readings, the kind of explosion of queer readings and queer criticism as a field. And yeah, what does feminist biblical studies look like? And actually, one thing I've found really interesting, I was having this conversation yesterday, is that feminist biblical studies almost kind of is a blurry thing now, because there are women writing that are feminists but aren't working on gender. But I wonder actually how much that blurring of being a feminist is coming into the work. So actually not texts that are explicitly taking a feminist kind of hermeneutic lens, but being that kind of standpoint of being a feminist or being a... trying to think of another standpoint you can have, but being persons with commitments and beliefs and principles and writing work. And actually it'd be really interesting to note that how it's more than just a hermeneutic lens now, it's a kind of a way of scholarship. And that's something that I've maybe done a little bit of thinking about, but how do we talk about these things and how do we talk about texts with our own commitments? And I think that's part of understanding that we're not just doing scientific criticism, just observing. We are an active agent in our interpretation. So, I'd be really interested to see kind of how that all merges together.
This is something I find weird in my own work, because like a lot of my work, apparently, as it's coming out and as I've been writing it, is focused on female figures and kind of texts that center women in some way. But then there's like a really weird disconnect in many ways, because the texts themselves are not really feminist, often not necessarily liberative. And my kind of overriding approach, I guess, is kind of historical critical. So I'm interested in like the social context of these texts. I'm interested in what they reflect in terms of history, history of belief, history of practice, this kind of stuff. But a large part of that, and something I found recently, I've just had like another thing come out on a queen in Josephus. And I've been writing this with Kat Quine. Kind of last year we were writing together on like a couple of things. And one of the things we ran into was just a lot of the scholarship around this particular queen. So Atalia, Hebrew Bible, she's like the only queen of Judah. She's meant to massacre like all these all the seed of David. Let's go back to that. But she, a lot of the stuff around her, writing on her, is like she's a bad figure. And how much of her kind of badness is to do with her gender. And it's really blurry and unclear. And some people kind of almost push it as far as saying, well, she's a woman in a man's role. Like she's a full-on queen. She's ruling in her own right. And this is what's wrong with it. But then that kind of then seems that when you can pay attention to gender in a certain way that actually doesn't really do much. So you ask questions of this woman occupying a role that you assume is a man's only role, that you wouldn't ask of, let's say, like a man like Manasseh, let's say, like another bad king. You don't ask the same questions about, how does his gender like overlay into his terrible rulership, or how the thing reacts to it. And there's almost like this kind of, I almost feel that a lot of my work almost steps back a little bit and tries to gender as a lens to think about with. But I just, sometimes it's almost helpful not using it as the overriding lens that everything else is written through. Again, on the other hand, like you've got to say, well, these texts are like in many ways patriarchal. The societies are definitely very patriarchal, male-centric and all this kind of stuff. So I wrestle with this quite a lot, because it's very, there's a lot of tension been held there.
And kind of two points that come out of that is, I think actually perhaps move towards more intersectional readings actually that focus on gender, ethnicity, kind of, I wouldn't say nationality then, but we can't really talk about nationality with Hebrew Bible very neatly, or kind of biblical text neatly, but kind of how class works and kind of positions and hierarchical orders and things like that. One thing that I've recently come across, I've got an article on Mordecai in drag with wrote with a friend, Joe Henson Marigold, coming out soon.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's about, very cool, very cool about Mordecai's drag, which might be the only excuse that I ever get to kind of legitimately watch RuPaul's Drag Race as an academic exercise. But one thing, kind of like one of the reviewers said, was about moving towards like heteriarchy rather than hierarchy, and kind of moving away from, and I went away and read some of them. While I'm not necessarily sure in the context of the paper, it's almost like a too big of an idea in a paper that talks about lots of things. But I went away and read some stuff on Carol Myers writing about moving away from patriarchy towards heteriarchy as a way to read the texts. And I'm going to probably butcher what I think heteriarchy is. But I know that there's been some stuff written in a book whose author escapes me about Queens of Assyria.
I know Sana Svard's written on ancient Near East.
No, that's Sana her Svard. Book, yeah. But Birmingham actually has a copy of it, but someone's got it online. so I can't be cheeky and be like, can someone photocopy some stuff for me? But no, she was writing on heteriarchy and about it's not that women can kind of operate with relations with like how they talk to each other. This is such a butchering of a term, but I found
I think I know actually it's Kat who's, I think, presented on some of this and the palaces of Nimrod, and it's like their particular roles and their power relationships with other women, and even with kind of men. But there's this like,
it's like
so long as you're occupying your role, it's kind of fine. And they're a lot more nuanced in terms of power relations, but it's if you break outside of that particular, it is like a gendered role. It's really, it's not just kind of a sex-based role, it is gendered.
Yeah, it's...
I think I'm getting that right.
Basically, we haven't read enough to kind of talk about this, but I found it... But yeah, is it... Sanaswad talks that heterarchal power is defined as power that is always present in interactions between individuals, regardless of their relative status to hierarchy. And I found that really interesting. And then Carol Meyer's writing about kind of moving away from patriarchy is maybe we think more about gender. And I think gender has come up more as a question. It's really interesting now. We're not just talking about kind of maybe 21st century ideas of gender and like how do they play out in the text, but what does gender mean in these texts, and how does gender operate as kind of as a tool, and how does the in-betweens of gender, not just male or female, that's terrible, that's sex, I should be better and more nuanced, but like how do categories of like man and woman blur together? They're not 100%, I think we think of them as absolute categories, and actually the most interesting conversations about gender, I think, happen in the in-betweens. But actually, why is someone not... What does it mean for Mordecai to be a man, for example, in Esther? Well, why isn't he performing that? What does that... What can we... How can we understand text if we look at it that way? And kind of, rather than assuming the text, assuming the characters presented with kind of manly names or masculine names or feminine names and just kind of taking it at first basis, I think... Yeah, that's a little bit of a waffle about, but I find gender kind of research, the way it's evolving and the way more conversations are being had, and how diverse it is. It's not just feminist biblical studies. We're not just talking about gender and feminist biblical studies, but as a kind of a tool in its own right and a kind of category in its own right to interrogate texts. So yeah, so interesting.
It's like the whole. Kind of push back against some feminist things from womanist perspectives. It's something I've come across with Susanna almost, because it's like Susanna in the addition to Daniel occupies this really odd position. Like she owns slaves. Like she's got, I think, two slaves who accompany her and has sent them away. So she's kind of like, you've got all these layers of, so she's set in an exile, but she also is a very prominent, wealthy woman married to this very prominent man, with kind of access to power. But then she's also a woman in this society, so her words, essentially, even at her own trial, she doesn't say anything. She can't say anything. So there's like these layers of privilege and oppression. And who was it? I think it was Jenny Grillo, I think, has written on... Susanna's slaves, who are just like, the narrative doesn't care about them, they just come and go, and in fact they're ashamed almost on behalf of Susanna. So there's this kind of like, when she's unveiled, they have this like they're ashamed on behalf of their mistress in some ways. So there's like this other thing where they're just kind of instrumentalized by the narrative as another like preservation of this let's say elite woman's honor. So there's all these other things going on that you wouldn't necessarily, because some other scholarship of Susanna just reads her as completely oppressed. Only in the Theodotion can she, I think, in one of the versions, maybe I'm misremembering this, can she even bring herself to cry out to God to save her? And there's such a, at least in the trial scene, in this kind of formalized setting, there's such a passivity to her in many ways. And there's this, like, there's really interesting readings going back and forth in terms of, like, her relative power, her relative positioning. You know, she's, like, a survivor of assault in many ways. So that there's, like, all these things going on that I think, moving not simply, like, a gendered lens, but thinking about class, thinking about race, thinking about relative power and this kind of stuff just adds more and more things to kind of consider and wonder how they're working.
Yeah, I think the kind of like idea of intersectionality was, I think it's Darren Guest again, wrote about kind of biblical studies, feminist biblical studies. I think it's Beyond Feminist Biblical Interpretation, I think that's the book.
That's the one that Hexham is like engaging with in this.
Yeah. But Darren talks about how feminist biblical scholarship is white, cis, middle-class women. And actually, these texts, these women in the texts aren't. This is a bit of a tangent. I'll come back to that in a second. But the idea that actually who is doing this interpretation, we're not going to see things because fundamentally we can't identify with them. I can't identify, not that I do much feminist biblical interpretation, but there's going to be things in text that I just won't see because it's never going to be an experience that I could relate to or I could even conceive of and it being an issue. But I think that's almost why there needs to be more diverse voices to tell these kind of stories and to read these texts, because actually are we ever going to understand these texts if we're kind of limited by our own perspective? And I think, so this relates to, I went to a screening of the Mary Magdalene film. Rooney Mara, the thing to take away from it is she's so white, is that Girl of Dragon Tattoo, she plays a Swedish woman. So if someone can play both a Swedish woman and kind of play into that very European, white European character, but then also be entrusted to play a first century Palestinian woman, actually are we telling Mary Magdalene's story? Because actually we've missed a massive like facet of her identity as someone that is not white. And what kind of story are we telling? It was really interesting, I think, actually seeing it on screen made it so visually striking as a commentary about biblical studies a lot of the time, is that actually if we're the Rooney Maras, we're the people telling those stories, and I say that as a kind of as a white woman, actually, are we telling those stories, or are we telling some kind of hashed version that only I can see or can tell because that's within my capabilities? And I just found that a really interesting tool to think through Darren Guest's comment. And it just really was stuck with me as, no, that's it. That's biblical interpretation in practice, when we are kind of really isolated and really...
Well, I think that the thing is that you can... So I've seen another thing going off on Twitter about... We're kind of currently on one end of a spectrum where people tend to be talking about how alien the ancient world is from us.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll kind of come back and that might have gone a bit far and we'll start saying, well, you know, people are people and they behave in quite similar ways, and we can maybe... like talk a little bit more about things like psychology or, you know, what people generally like. But I think that kind of alienation from our sources in the ancient world is quite beneficial, because then it isn't, and maybe this is something that is, I don't know, I want to play a weakness of mine as a strength, where it's like actually reading women in text has to be an alienating experience for me. Mm. Like it's not something I can identify with really readily. So it's kind of, you have to be aware of your own bias and positioning,
mm-hmm.
Very much to then think about what it's like to occupy this kind of thought world or this textual world. And it's the same with, like, I'm not Jewish, coming in and kind of working exclusively on Jewish texts and Jewish history really is another kind of thing where I have to be very aware of stepping outside and kind of into another tradition that is not mine. So it's like that kind of knowing that you're engaging in something in which you don't really participate forces you to be a little bit more cautious about claiming certain things. I think that can be helpful.
I think it's really interesting kind of saying that, because I think actually having that knowledge that you're an outsider in the first place takes a while to get to, because I don't know, the Bible is such a, especially when we're doing religious texts like the Bible, whether it be the Hebrew Bible, New Testament, or kind of everything in between, these are scriptures that are used, and they're not just religious scriptures, but there's a cultural the cultural Bible. The Bible is so seeped into everyday, it's seeped into everyday life so much that actually when we talk about the Bible, we have some sort of ownership in it, because we think we do anyway, because, well, this is the song I used to sing, like this is a story I used to say at Sunday school, or this is a text that, or like Daniel with writings on the wall, that's a phrase that I use in my everyday language. So there's always like these kind of little threads that we have to these texts, but almost I wonder actually how much that plays into when we go to read them, gives us some sort of like ownership over these texts, when actually that couldn't be further from the truth. These aren't, especially when maybe I'm not Jewish, not religious in any shape or form, actually approaching these texts, they're not my texts. They are religious texts of a community, the community that produced them, and I'm not part of that community. But because of the way the Bible has kind of integrated into our own culture in the 21st century, actually unpicking that ownership and kind of relationship to the text is always really tricky. And yeah, it'd be interesting to kind of know more about, and I'm definitely probably not the person to ask about this, because cultural reception of the Bible is not my forte, but there definitely are people that can speak much more knowledgeably. But it's really interesting that relationship we have to these texts now as Western scholars especially. And this really interesting article that I keep coming back to, but about kind of, so talking about the Book of Esther again, Timothy Beale has a book about writing, and a lot of scholarship on Esther. There's an article that came out this year actually in Open Theology about the importance of writing in the Book of Esther and what that means. And there's a really great article by Jerry Snyman, published quite a few years ago. I say quite a few years ago, maybe 7 or 8. so not that long. But he talks about the kind of textuality, the importance that Western scholars place on textuality, because we always see the Bible as a text and we always see these things as texts. But actually, the way that the Bible is used in different cultures is not text. It's an oral artifact, or it's something that's passed down. It's a visual one. It's not always text. And our focus on kind of the text, maybe the codification of this text, and treating the Bible as the Bible, canonized and structured in that way, and as a written document, how much that plays into our interpretation, how much of that we see in the, when we're doing our interpretation, and how when we read these texts as texts, when was that the case when kind of when these stories were being told or being thought up? How does that relate to kind of their ancient origins or their ancient context? And it's such a thought-provoking article that's really stayed with me, is there's so much unsaid assumptions and presuppositions that is written into the practice of interpretation. I don't always think that we do very well to unpick ourselves. We need that outside voice almost to kind of be like, what the hell are you doing? Rather than just, yes, this is interpretation. This is how we do it. We do X, Y, Z and we get a result.
You know what we've just done, as we've just been kind of talking quite freely, I've realised that we've touched on themes from all four of the first episodes we've recorded. Like that's kind of very strange in some ways, but maybe it's just what's been in our mind. But even that last thing I was thinking about, having recently done the editing for Tupa's interview and talking about, the Decalogue, that the laws are sealed away not to be read. So there's like this kind of really, but all throughout I realised, I remember that from kind of that interview. And I think that's the kind of cool thing. It's just like the same, very similar conversations and ideas circulating around. And clearly they're informing our own thoughts, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, that Tupa's interview, oh my God. When talking about kind of, talking about the Decalogue, which is the text I work on for my PhD, Decalogue and the Covenant Code, and kind of the writing of it is something I'd never really paid much attention to because I was always interested in the content of the laws and what, how they function and what are the laws saying. But actually, it is, yes, it's very written, it's hidden away. And it's really interesting as well, I was having this conversation yesterday about the later reception of this text. There's a American Horror Story has a season called Hotel, and it's all based on the Ten Commandments. So if anyone wants to commission me to write about horror and the Ten Commandments, I would love to, because it's, what's really interesting as well, they become moral codes. The texts are rewritten to almost become moral codes rather than kind of cultic and social ones. But the locking away of these artifacts of what happens in the series is that there's the killer kills these people according to the Ten Commandments, very inventive, of adultery. There two people are kind of shot with an arrow while having sex as an kind of exposition of their adultery, and then the killer takes like a trophy from each one, like a little idol, and takes it back to his hotel room in this creepy hotel, this like magic-y hotel. And once you get in the hotel room, there's another room inside that hotel room which the idol is placed in this cabinet, right? Kind of Ark of Covenant in the tabernacle sort of idea. It's really playing on, and it's, but the idea that these kind of codes or stipulations or laws, however you want to call them, are represented by objects that can then be locked away and still kind of represent that thing. And yeah, Tupper's episode really got my brain going every direction. But yeah, someone would like to hire me to write something on American Horror Story and the Ten Commandments. Would love that.
I've just had a thought about, because perhaps the most famous or one of the most famous fictional representations of the Ark of the Covenant, of course, Indiana Jones. Which, and I was wondering how many of the commandments are broken in that film, and is that why, like, you know, like that's why everyone is kind of melted at the end? Because I was just thinking about it, because there's all this kind of thing going on, with, like, you know, not respecting gods and ancient tombs, and there's lots of stealing and coveting going on and murder, and it's like, I wonder if you went through, if that was a thing they were kind of thinking about, and there's like all the commandments are broken, maybe that'd be quite fun to do a watch and think about that.
This is one thing I'm having to like unpick with my own research, is because of Utopia, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Utopia is a colonialist endeavor. What does Utopos comes in, he severs the connection with the mainland. He then sets about creating an identical population where everyone looks the same. They have horrible foreign politics by which they can take slaves from other places, but they can't be slaves themselves. Does this sound familiar from the Covenant Code?
this is something that's really strikes me in terms of, it's a conversation that was going on recently, either at British New Testament Society or some kind of recent conference. I think it was Paul Middleton, who I saw someone live tweeting his paper, and he was saying, like, we're very much on, like, oh, the revelation of John is going to be it's liberative. Like, a lot of this apocalypse is liberative. And you're like, no, it doesn't. It completely just, it doesn't actually change social order. Mm-hmm. It just puts you on top. And that's completely, the system isn't flawed. It's just, I'm not running the system. That's the issue you have.
This is, again, but yeah, the utopian thing of like, no, it's not a better world. It's one where you rule.
Yeah.
It's like Plato and the Republic talking about the best world is the world ruled by philosopher kings and wisdom and ideas of kind of justice and all the, it's like, no, what you've just decided is that you would like to be in charge. Therefore, you've designed your world on that and kind of fuck everybody else. Mm. And, but that's the, like, talking about the promised land, like the land of milk and honey and the land that's ever so fertile. And the myth of the empty land, I mean, God, that's the colonialist, like, slogan for the last 3,000 years. The land's empty. I'll send an angel out and clear the land for you, and then you can walk into this land that's full of milk and honey, that's, no one will be barren, no one will miscarry. And like in Joshua, you see that like rift between the kind of realised utopia and then actually there were people that I find Joshua really fascinating because of that, because you get that dialogue of like, this is our land. You get the that real kind of ideology of land and no, this is our land, this is our place. And then you actually get the fractures in that land, that fractures in that kind of ideology, because you have God admitting to Joshua that there's still people in the land. And that really interesting discourse of, this is our land now, reinforced by the fact that it's not their land. And what do you do with that? And that's, I find that really fascinating. And one of those kind of, ruptures in the national myth of Israel.
But you can see that in a text which isn't, or in texts which don't actually challenge global order. Like, they don't challenge question of empire. They don't. It's just
the wrong empire. Replacement.
Yeah, it's wrong empire.
You've been listening to Ancient Afterlives. If you'd like to contact us, you can find us on Twitter. Thanks for listening.